Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Living Proof's dry shampoo is so good at actually cleaning hair that you can take a spin class and not wash your hair after. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the Living Proof. And by Squarespace, providing tools that help people showcase their passions with a customized landing page, website, or online store. Also offering domains, hosting, and 24/7 support. Get your free trial at squarespace.com/modernlove. You should. Squarespace.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Let's face it, people love to judge millennials, especially when it comes to relationships. Because, you know, millennials, as the haters would have it, they're all callow and shallow. Well, Emma Court is going to change your mind. Here's Emmy Rossum reading Emma's essay, A Millennial's Guide to Kissing.
When a total stranger kissed me under the artificial lights of an airplane cabin somewhere above international waters, my first thought was of the orthodox woman sitting to my left. I hoped she was asleep. It was a 12-hour flight from Tel Aviv to Newark, and I wanted to nap, too. But how could I now? The kiss, coming out of nowhere, had turned me into the heroine of a bad romance novel. Heart fluttering, weak-kneed, every nerve electrified. My stranger and I were returning from Birthright Israel trips with groups from our respective universities. Birthright Israel is a free 10-day trip to Israel for young Jewish Americans, and I had wanted to go before I graduated. Last winter, before my final semester of college, I finally had. Because there are so many young people on Birthright Israel trips, they're often mocked as an attempt to spark a connection to Israel through the bedroom. And plenty of that had happened on my trip. But it hadn't happened to me until that moment. Spoiling the perfect narrative of two strangers meeting on an airplane, I admit that we had met before, just once, briefly, when I bumped into a friend from high school during a stop in Jerusalem. One of her friends had been cute, I had remembered. And now here he was behind me as we boarded the airplane, then bending his tall frame into the aisle seat next to me. As he lifted his backpack into the overhead compartment, I marveled at my luck. Between us sprang the kind of instant intimacy fostered by open personalities in tight quarters. We spoke in spurts about the gossip on our trips and what we had done during the days spent in Israel. We flirted. We kissed that first time. And then we kissed again. Splitting a pair of headphones, we listened to the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Taylor Swift. I liked how easy he was. How ready to talk. I liked his laugh and his dark eyes. It seemed torn from the back of a Nicholas Sparks paperback, a Southern science major from a small liberal arts school, and a Northern humanities major from a huge pre-professional university, meet in the skies over the Mediterranean. The heat between them is palpable. But less romantic details persisted. I was a senior, about to start my second semester with plans to head to Dallas after graduation. He was a sophomore, with the swaddling comfort of knowing where he'd be for the next few years. But it didn't matter anyway, did it? In 12 hours, we'd be back on paths that led us in opposite directions. This meeting was just a romantic interlude from our real lives. And if it did mean anything, we were college students. We knew how to pretend it didn't. on the plane, the lights came back on and the breakfast cart appeared. Reality set in as we sipped orange juice from tinfoil-covered cups and for the first time had little to say to each other. During the bumpy landing, he distracted me by talking about famous airplane crashes. And then with a final jarring thump, we were back on the ground. As we gathered our belongings from what had been our temporary home, I wondered what would happen next. We bought tickets at the train terminal, lingering on the automated buttons. After, as we were about to board trains heading in different directions, we stared at each other. He rested one arm on his rolling suitcase, bewilderment in his dark eyes. I hugged him, a brisk, no-nonsense goodbye. We didn't exchange numbers. "Bye," he shouted down the stairs at my back. "See you never." I couldn't tell if he was serious or joking. Even embracing the more positive of the possibilities, it still stung. And that should have been it. A story I told, giggling, to friends, until the details faded, and he was just a boy whose name I didn't remember. But I saw his name on my Facebook newsfeed in a batch of photos our mutual friend had uploaded, and I couldn't resist. I clicked Add Friend. And one day, he messaged me. "Hey." "Hey," I typed back. "How's life?" It went like this for days. But talking to him made me feel like a time traveler, spliced between the snowy paths of my campus and the darkened airplane we had shared. I was sitting in class or at meetings at the local campus cafe, doing my readings in the library, and then a message on my screen would tug me back. I didn't like the way it upset my balance, how far away and powerless it made me feel. Mass media has a fascination with hookup culture among people around my age, meriting in-depth investigations and contentious opining about what it all means. But they often miss a simple fact. There's nothing particularly new about trying to avoid getting hurt. It's just that my generation has turned this avoidance into a science, perfecting the separation of the physical from the emotional. We truncate whenever possible, texting over calling, meeting over apps rather than in person. We leave in the early morning without saying goodbye. Being casual is cooler than intimacy or vulnerability, or so we think. Having the last word was once a sign of one's wits and smarts. It meant that your comment had gravitas and staying power. But today, having the last word is the ultimate weakness. It means being the person who doesn't merit an answer. Better to leave them hanging than risk the same happening to you. Keep it shallow so your heart isn't on the line. Being aware of all this does not grant immunity from its effects. One night, my roommate's hookup rolled over in the dark and asked her in a half murmur, "Is this a special thing?" Confused, rubbing the sleep from her eyes, she asked him to repeat himself. She wasn't certain she'd heard him correctly. "Never mind," he said. Later, she worried she had missed a crucial moment, one that she would never get back. But if she had misunderstood, she risked showing her hand by revealing that she wanted him to stick around in the morning. It was too scary a prospect, so she never said anything. Was my airplane interlude a special thing? Would things have been different if one of us had had the courage to say something other than goodbye before heading to our trains? On the platform, walking away from him, I had decided that the whole affair was just one of many half-formed romantic liaisons that trail you in your youth. But maybe that attitude was also the problem. At the time, I had had an inexplicable comfort level with it all. I only realized later why it had been such an oddly familiar feeling. My generation treats every liaison as if it's happening on an airplane. As if we have only that one night and there is no tomorrow. I don't know what else could have happened. But I wonder what we collectively lose as we try so hard not to care. He and I don't communicate anymore. He moved on. And so did I. But in my head, I go back to that train platform. I turn to him. Say goodbye. And then, recalling his parting words, I say them right back. See you never.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Awesome. Reading Emma Court's essay, A Millennial's Guide to Kissing. See you never, he said. But was that really the case? We'll find out from Emma Court after the break.
I'm Katie at Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, I've used so many dry shampoos, but my hair still gets greasy, and I wear a ponytail by day three. Your dry shampoo has my hair so clean and full of body that it's still down on day four. This is the most effective dry shampoo I've ever used. Love, Kat. You can use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from the author of this week's essay, Emma Court, and Modern Love editor Daniel Jones.
So Emma Court's piece came in as part of our college essay contest, which bring in anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 essays from college students nationwide. And what I think Emma did so well was how she compares every relationship that she and her friends have as being like a relationship that takes place on an airplane, as though there's no tomorrow, you know, as though you're not talking about anything in the future. And for them, it filters down to, well, we're not going to call this anything. We're not going to have any expectations. And that really takes a toll.
So when I wrote the piece, I think the place that I was coming from was this sort of like, me and my friends eating brunch and complaining about guys sort of place where I felt like this was something that a lot of women were experiencing. But what really surprised me with the reaction to my piece was how many guys reached out to me and said, you know, they understood, they felt the same way.
It used to be more of the stereotypical man was the person who didn't want to commit and the woman was the person who did. And now I just see much more equality in that, but it means that no one can really make a move.
So the sort of anticlimactic part about my piece is that I did actually speak to See You Never Boy. So before the piece came out, I thought that it was only fair to let him know that it was coming out. He asked if he could see it, so I sent it to him. I was pretty nervous about it, but he actually really liked the piece, and he said that it had changed the way he had thought about relationships, and perhaps he had been a little bit callous in sort of saying goodbye in the way that he did, and I think that he understands perhaps how the other person could feel, and I think that's something we could all stand to do a lot more of in relationships. On the whole, the way that romantic relationships are portrayed in mass media does a real disservice to everyone, men and women alike. We don't see relationships in their like full complexity. We see them sort of boiled down to something that makes an interesting plot, right? Which is this sort of like cartoonish version of how men and women behave.
What cultural influence comes up more in these college essays than anything else is Disney movies. You find the right person, you see each other, your eyes get really big, and then that's it, and that's love. So when you're young and you're fed Disney fantasies, you think, that's what I'm going to have, you know? Right now, I'm just doing this gritty mess of, like, trying to be with a guy or be with a girl or whatever, and that's just because I haven't found real love yet. And they think of real love as being something separate from whatever this experiment is that they're in the middle of. But that is real love, you know? That is what it is, and there is no one person out there where everything is going to come easily.
Perhaps people just need to talk about it a little bit more openly. I think that was the intent of my piece, was to try to take something that I thought a lot of people felt and put it out there in sort of an honest way.
Emma Court on her essay, A Millennial's Guide to Kissing, and Modern Love editor Daniel Jones. Special thanks to Emmy Rossum for reading this week's essay. You can see her right now in the TV series Shameless on Showtime. Well, we asked you for your stories about finding big love in unusual places, and here's a little of what you've sent us so far.
I met my great love at a castle in the Netherlands.
I met her in my neuroscience 100 class.
I met the love of my life at a strip club.
We'll be featuring some of those stories in a bonus episode that we'll release early next week, so stay tuned for that. And next week on Modern Love...
After 5 loving, fulfilling years with my boyfriend, Drew, I suddenly found myself online, looking to meet a woman.
Modern Family's Jesse Tyler Ferguson brings us the story of one gay couple's complicated road to fatherhood. Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It is produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast is courtesy of APM. And special music this week from Luke Kirkland. Oh, and by the way, before I sign off for this week, I'm going to guess that you've got some strong feelings about this podcast, so leave us a review on iTunes and let us know what you think. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll see you next week.